Charian?
Yes. May it please the Court. My name is Limo Charian, and I represent the plaintiffs, appellants in this case. The plaintiffs in this case are four equipment financing companies that loan money to an organization called LCRAD International. LCRAD turned out to be an elaborate hoax and fraud. The appeal before the court this morning is the appeal of a dismissal of three counts that the plaintiffs brought against First Union Bank. The counts are for fraudulent concealment, violations of the Uniform Fraudulent.
Did LCRAD enter bankruptcy?
No, LCRAD was not put into bankruptcy and did not file bankruptcy. The plaintiffs brought this case against LCRAD initially in the district court for breach of contract.
Is there any reason that you know of? I mean, these kinds of preference recovery or avoidance actions are naturals for bankruptcy and much more easily administered there.
Your Honor, I'm not certain why the bankruptcy was not pursued. I think the elaborateness of the fraud was discovered over the course of the litigation. Initially, there were several leasing companies.
Bankruptcy isn't limited to fraud. Bankruptcy is what happens when you can't pay your debts as they come due, and it's perfectly clear LCRAD couldn't pay its debts as they came due.
Your Honor, it's a puzzle.
I mean, normally one thinks of these preference recovery actions or fraudulent conveyance as being recovered for the benefit of all creditors. You're essentially trying for your own preference.
Your Honor, the original claim against First Union was brought by the receiver, and that action was dismissed by the district court for lack of standing. And the First Union made the argument at that point that the receiver of LCRAD did not have the standing to pursue that action on behalf of the creditors.
Yeah, there's another thing that nobody would look twice at if this were in bankruptcy. So it looks like there's been a whole lot of waste here. Could have been avoided in a bankruptcy, but you know the world is as it is, so please don't let me detain you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address, first of all, the dismissal of the second count against First Union, which is count 19, violation of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act. The trial court's dismissal was based solely on analysis of whether the transfer to First Union was a preference. In fact, this is not a preference case. This is not a situation where the debtor had certain assets and simply chose one creditor over another. The allegations in the case are that the plaintiffs loaned money to LCRAD for equipment lease financing, and that LCRAD, having no other business income, used those funds to pay credit card debt to First Union. So this is not a situation where we're talking about income or assets of the debtor that are simply going to pay one creditor over another. So we believe the trial court's analysis of that under simply a question of preference is incorrect. In the complaint, we actually pled both fraud in fact and fraud in law under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act. With respect to the fraud in fact count, the plaintiffs have pled that LCRAD intended to defraud creditors, and specifically the plaintiffs in this case, by using the proceeds of their equipment lease financing for personal gain and to pay First Union. And we also alleged the badges of fraud that were set forth in the statute, six of them, in fact. However, the court did not analyze the badges of fraud and simply concluded that because it was a mere preference was not enough to satisfy intent. But we do believe that the intent was adequately pled. Additionally, the fraud in law count was never addressed by the court. The complaint pleads very specifically that the transfer to First Union was made without adequate consideration and without reasonably equivalent consideration, and that it depleted the assets of the corporation. So under the fraud in law portion of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act, we believe the complaint should have been sustained and not dismissed. I'd also like to address the first count against First Union, which is the fraudulent concealment count. Now, while this count was entitled fraudulent concealment, the facts pled within the count sustain a theory of recovery under the fruits of the fraud theory, wherein First Union would be liable for knowing acceptance of the fruits of a fraud. Under Federal Rule 9B, knowledge could be averred generally, and the trial court did not analyze it under this provision, but rather simply dismissed the fraudulent concealment count solely on the issue of whether there was a duty from First Union to the plaintiffs. It's not the basis of our theory for recovery. The theory for recovery against First Union is that they knowingly accepted the fruits of a fraud when they took money from LACRAD with, and we pled the facts that, you know, we believe were suspicious with respect to the way that the credit cards were used, that there were 50 credit cards for people who were, we believe, are either non-existent or deceased, and that the way that the credit cards were used with convenience checks to the maximum of the individual credit limit. And then First Union, we actually asked for leave to replead after the motion to dismiss was filed to allege that First Union, in fact, had filed a complaint and would have gained knowledge of LACRAD's financial transactions through the complaint. And also, the First Union had at one point filed a complaint with the FBI and then subsequently withdrew that complaint. We believe that those facts are sufficient to allege knowledge as to the extent that knowledge is required under 9B at all, other than generally, and that the fraudulent concealment count should have been sustained for that reason. The court also relied on the fact that that there was no argument that the plaintiffs could not have discovered the fraud. However, we did plead in the complaint that the plaintiffs, that LACRAD had used false financial statements and that did not disclose its true financial dealings, and that the plaintiffs were prevented.
Did you plead First Union's knowledge and awareness that LACRAD was defrauding somebody else or just First Union?
Our allegation is that that First Union was aware that LACRAD had that the proceeds going to First Union were fraudulently obtained because LACRAD had no business operations. So LACRAD made an out of the ordinary course of business payment to First Union of approximately $1.5 million in the year 2000, which is the year that the plaintiffs in this action had lent in excess of about $12 million to LACRAD. At the time, First Union had actually already filed a complaint. Our allegation is that First Union's knowledge is that LACRAD, having no business operations and then receiving an out of ordinary course of business payment of $1.5 million, would have known or should have known that this did not come from any legitimate operations, but from fraud against other people, although it's not specifically pled who the fraud would be against. That First Union would have known. There's no specific relationships between First Union and the plaintiffs in any in the course of. There are no dealings between the plaintiffs and First Union.
So the allegation is that First Union should have known that LACRAD was defrauding others because
LACRAD had no business operations because they were a shell entity with no assets and a sudden influx of $1.5 million for a corporation that doesn't have any.
So any money that it must have obtained to pay First Union back on the line of credit must have been fraudulently obtained.
Because the corporation had no legitimate business activity. That is the allegation with respect to knowledge. But again, Your Honor, this is with one of the issues in this case was the complaint was dismissed at the pleading stage before any discovery was allowed to be taken. And our under 9B, we believe that the knowledge of First Union could be averred generally. And we believe that there are sufficient circumstances that we've pled to give rise to the allegation that First Union had knowledge. Again, specifically also with respect to the lawsuit that was filed by First Union against LACRAD, wherein they would have been able to find out LACRAD's financial dealings. So with respect to the dismissal, the court simply just did not address the questions of whether the pleading standard was met under 9B, and it didn't, and simply dismissed the complaint without allowing discovery in the case, without considering the fruits of the fraud theory, which makes a party liable for accepting the fruits of the fraud if they are knowledgeable. And the court focused entirely on the question of duty. And again, we believe that under the fruits of the fraud theory, that you don't need to plead a duty between the third party and the person who is defrauded.
Is that a tort theory?
Your Honor, it's a theory of recovery within fraud. It's a way to prove third-party liability for fraud. It's not a separate cause of action, but it's a theory that's recognized in the Illinois courts. We've cited some cases regarding that that would make a third party liable for, to the extent of the I mean, not for the entire fraud of the plaintiffs, but to the extent that they received proceeds from the fraud. We've alleged the First Union failed to notify appropriate banking authorities, didn't file SARS reports. Again, at one point there was the FBI complaint, which was submitted and withdrawn. So we believe that these allegations are sufficient to show the First Union knew. And again, it may even rise to the level of participation. But again, at this stage, it's early. It's sort of too early to say how actively, if at all, First Union participated, but we do believe it rises to the level of knowledge of the, of fraud. The court also dismissed the unjust enrichment claim, focusing only on the fact, again, that there was no duty from First Union to the plaintiffs. But with respect to the unjust enrichment claim, the elements which were applied are simply that there was an unjust benefit that was retained by First Union to the plaintiff's detriment that violates fundamental principles of justice, equity, and good conscience. In this instance, the plaintiffs lent money for equipment financing, and LeCrad simply turned around and gave that money to pay off its credit card debt. And the credit card debt wasn't even legitimate.
That sounds like the argument that all preferences are invalid and can be recovered. The argument could be made in the event of any preference among creditors, but, of course, your brief concedes that that's not true. So how is your argument any different from a backdoor attempt to make all preferences voidable?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it is an argument that all preferences are avoidable. We're not talking about a situation where there's income to the corporation or assets of the corporation. This was specific equipment lease financing, and we would argue that that specific purpose, that when LeCrad diverted that, that plaintiffs have no greater right. In
fact,
that's
just what makes it a preference, right? Could you identify something that would be treated as a preference recoverable in bankruptcy that, in your view, could not be recovered in an action such as this?
Your Honor, with respect to the bankruptcy preferences, I mean, arguably just the timing of it, of the assets, regardless of where the assets came from, would be recoverable.
No. Could you address my question? Could you identify a preference that could be recovered in bankruptcy, but on your view could not be recovered as unjust enrichment?
No, Your Honor. I believe that the preferences in bankruptcy probably would, anything that would be recoverable in bankruptcy could also be recovered under an unjust enrichment.
But then we come back to the point that you concede, and it's, I think, well established in Illinois law, that preferences are not automatically recoverable in actions like this. But if there is no thing that would be treated as a preference that isn't recoverable under your theory, it looks like you're just contradicting the principle that preferences aren't automatically recoverable.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that they're automatically recoverable.
But then that leads to my question. What is the set of things that would be treated as a preference but cannot be recovered under your unjust enrichment theory?
Your Honor, again, I don't know that I can think of anything specifically.
Okay.
That would fall within that category.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Finally, Your Honor, our basis for the appeal is simply that the pleading standards, which were, again, this was the first complaint by the plaintiffs against these defendants, were met sufficiently that dismissal should not have been granted.
Fine.
Yes,
thank you, Ms. Jarian. Mr. Grady?
Good morning. May it please the court. The district court properly dismissed this case, and this court should affirm the district court for three reasons. First, plaintiffs have failed to plead any facts which, even by inference, might show that First Union had knowledge of the vast fraud scheme that LaCroix engaged against others. Second, plaintiffs' fraudulent conveyance allegations at most allege a proper payment by LaCroix to First Union. And finally, dismissal with prejudice in this case was proper because amendment would be futile. First, plaintiffs have confirmed this morning that their fraudulent concealment claim is gone, so I will not address that, but I'll instead focus on the unpled fruits of the fraud theory. Now, in their Fourth Amendment complaint, plaintiffs describe themselves as institutional lenders. There's no connection between First Union and the plaintiffs. Instead, plaintiffs agree that in order to state a claim against us, they must plead under the fruits of the fraud theory that we knowingly accepted the fruits of fraudulent conduct. Now, what does that mean under Illinois law? Knowing acceptance of fruits of the fraud means, under the Palfus case, which plaintiffs cite, which relies on Moore versus Pinkert, the seminal Illinois case, that First Union accepted LaCroix's funds knowing of the fraudulent means by which they were obtained. Now, although plaintiff's complaint goes into great detail about the fraudulent schemes that LaCroix perpetrated upon others, it's virtually silent about how First Union could possibly have knowledge of what LaCroix was been doing. They don't allege how First Union could have known that LaCroix was a shell, as counsel told you a moment ago. The shell status is irrelevant if it can't be traced to First Union's knowledge of that fact. Now, plaintiffs argue in their opening brief that they've sufficiently pled First Union's knowledge, and they focus entirely on paragraph 197 of their complaint. In fact, it's the amendment to their Fourth Amendment complaint. But the most they plead in paragraph 197 is that in the middle of 1999, First Union became aware that LaCroix was, quote, fraudulently misusing its First Union credit card account. But other than the words fraudulent misuse, what have they really pled? Well, Your Honors, they've pled that LaCroix was an active borrower who fell behind. In paragraph 195, they say that every month in 1998 and 1999, LaCroix would cash First Union convenience checks up to the authorized limit. Then, in paragraph 197, they allege that LaCroix paid First Union $1.5 million in 2000 and 2001. But that's all plaintiffs say about the evidence that First Union had about LaCroix's fraud. Plaintiffs allege nothing that could possibly have alerted First Union of what was going on behind the scenes at LaCroix, that LaCroix was engaging in fraud against third parties, let alone fraud against sophisticated third parties, like institutional lenders such as plaintiffs. Now, the mere fact that First Union suspended LaCroix's account. That was a plaintiff's attempted to make much of that fact, the suspension. But fraudulent misuse, which leads to suspension of a credit card account, is not enough to infer that First Union had knowledge of LaCroix's fraud toward third parties. It's apples and oranges. Plaintiffs have failed to allege how First Union could possibly have known about LaCroix's fraud. Now, that could be why in paragraph 197, plaintiffs actually water down their pleading standard. They don't say that First Union knew about the fraud. They say that First Union knew or should have known. But that's not the standard in Illinois. In fact, under the Palfus case, which plaintiffs cite, Judge Plunkett said that the standard is that they must allege that First Union deliberately ignored facts which suggested fraud. But what facts? With what they've alleged, plaintiff's argument, if it's accepted, would cast far too wide of a net. Banks don't have knowledge of fraud simply because their borrowers have reached their borrowing limit, they're delinquent with their loans, and then they partially repay them.
Counsel, do you know why no bankruptcy was ever instituted?
I do not, Your Honor. But I know that someone in plaintiff's position could have instituted involuntary proceeding.
Well, you need another creditor to go along, although it certainly sounds like there were many other creditors. You could have gotten two or five or any number that would have been required. Okay, well, it just left as a puzzle, I guess.
Your Honors, the lending process does not, in and of itself, create a crystal ball which allows banks to know what their clients are doing with the money. Nor does it give a crystal ball that allows banks to know what their clients are doing with other money. If that's plaintiff's argument, they're standing in a glass house, because they too are institutional lenders and they too lent money to LaCroix, yet they apparently didn't know about the fraud either. So plaintiffs would impose an impossible investigative burden on banks. They would require lenders to investigate every delinquent borrower.
I guess I'd give up. But the kind of claim they're making here, if this were a bankruptcy proceeding, would be a perfectly straightforward avoidance action by the trustee. Your client did receive a preference. The trustee would indeed have clawed it back for the benefit of the estate. There's nothing that the lender that Bell is asking for here that would be abnormal in bankruptcy. Right? Your client would not retain a preferred position had there been a bankruptcy proceeding. It's one of the puzzles. You're now arguing, it sounds like, for some inherent right of the first lender who gets there and scoops up the money to keep it, but there's no such right had a bankruptcy been initiated. I understand why you didn't want to initiate a bankruptcy, because you would have been the target of the preference recovery. I don't understand why they and other creditors wouldn't have wanted to initiate the bankruptcy, because your client would have had to cough up its preference for the benefit of the other creditors.
Your Honor, as you said, I believe it's a mystery. Now, the district court cases the plaintiff's cite are not to the contrary. The defendants in those cases, all of them, were involved directly or indirectly in the fraud. Your Honors, moving on to the second point, which concerns fraudulent conveyance. These allegations that the plaintiffs make as to fraudulent conveyance establish at most a proper payment to First Union. The fact that First Union was repaid by funds that LaCroix obtained through an equipment lease financing, I don't think that's relevant. Plaintiffs are not suggesting that somehow the funds couldn't have been used for any purpose that LaCroix wanted. And even if they could, we received them without notice of any violation of any loan or certainly any fraud. But with regard to the fraud and law theory, plaintiffs must allege inadequate consideration, but yet they admit that First Union was owed by LaCroix and that when it received LaCroix's payment, the debt was reduced. That's consideration, and that should end that analysis. As to the fraud in fact theory, that claim requires a specific intent to defraud under Illinois law, and certainly no allegation has been made here that First Union intended to defraud any of the plaintiffs. Finally, with respect to unjust enrichment, which we briefly discussed, there can be no unjust benefit when the payment is supported by consideration, as plaintiffs have alleged here. Now, when the district court dismissed with prejudice, it did so because apparently amendment, in its view, would have been futile. And, in fact, that is the case. In their briefing, plaintiffs offer three additional facts they say would make a difference if they went back down to the district court. First, that First Union withdrew a notice to the FBI once it was paid. But plaintiffs don't suggest that that notice had anything to do with fraud against third parties. Second, that First Union learned on July 7, 2000, that LaCroix's financial statements were false. Again, that was in the collection action which First Union filed against LaCroix, and there's no suggestion that the fact that false financial statements existed is evidence that LaCroix was defrauding third parties. Finally, that First Union sued LaCroix in the collection action, that of course has no significance if all First Union was doing was trying to collect its debt.
Was there any request to replead lodged in the district court?
Your Honor, I believe yes. There was a motion to reconsider filed that I remember specifically, and it was there was a request made to replead.
In the motion for reconsideration?
I believe so.
Okay.
None of these facts, Your Honor, plaintiffs would amend with show that First Union knew of LaCroix's fraud toward others, let alone that it was a fraudulent scheme. In this case, the district court properly exercises discretion in dismissing with prejudice. If there are no other questions, I'll conclude my argument.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, you had used up all your rebuttal time, but I'll allow you 1 minute.
Your Honor, I just want to address one thing, which is the argument that there was consideration for the transfers. We've cited case law to the court showing that when corporate officers use corporate assets for personal and pecuniary gain, there's no consideration to the corporation, and so we believe that the First Union's defense of adequate consideration is not valid here. I don't have anything else to add unless the court has questions.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement. The court.